Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you see when you picture a classic California landscape? Verdant groves of orange trees, graceful palms, or do redwoods or eucalyptus come to mind? The modern history of the state is also a history of horticultural manipulation and occasional mistakes, the consequence of introducing vast numbers of trees and irrigation-dependent plants into country that had once been more brown than green. And as my guest will tell us, there have also been some triumphs, such as the conservation of old-growth redwood stands despite potential profits to be harvested by cutting them down. Jared Farmer teaches history at Stony Brook University. He's in town to receive the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture for his new book, Trees in Paradise, A California History. Jared, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You say that considering the natural and unnatural history of trees in California will cause us to never look at a landscape the same way again. Can you talk about how that happened for you as you were researching this project?
Yeah, so I'm basically a landscape historian, but I want to think about the landscape in the most complicated, multi-dimensioned way. And I like looking at natural elements of the landscape or things that seem natural. And trees, which are our neighbors, our friends, they're always a part of our lives, seem very natural, often very beautiful. But there's a whole lot of human history, cultural history, as well as this kind of unnatural part. The trees are this great combination of, you know, something that's other, that's organic, that's non-human. Trees have lives and deaths of their own, but then, you know, humans can plant them, manipulate them, grow them, harvest from them. And to me, California is like the perfect place, I think better than almost any state in the U.S. and maybe any place in the world for looking at the ways humans interact with both native trees and introduced trees and all the complicated ways that that story plays out.
This book was a great reminder of our tendency to overlook the fact that trees were a huge natural resource that drew European settlers to what became the United States.
Oh, yeah. So if you think of like U.S. history moving east to west, it's more complicated than that because, of course, if you think of Texas being a good example, actually history often goes south to north. But, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at the traditional textbooks, it's still a largely east to west story. English, German immigrants, people coming from northern Central Europe are encountering an amazing forest landscape, one that's heavily modified by Native Americans, but has way more trees than Europe has had in hundreds, maybe thousands of years, because the great forests of Europe had been largely chopped down. And Americans did their best to chop down the entire eastern woodland forest and succeeded and basically got used to this very profligate kind of wood use because it seemed like the forest could never run out. And again, from a European perspective, it just was this incredible abundance. But then you get to, of course, the prairie, the Rocky Mountains, the far west. That's a very different story. And here, outside of certain pockets in say, the Northwest or California, it's mostly a story of people planting rather than cutting. And so this is sort of like the yin and yang of like Americans' history with trees. You think of, say, Paul Bunyan, this mythical character, like cutting down really big trees. You also think of like Johnny Appleseed planting trees. This is both a big part of U.S. history, planting and cutting. And in California, both these things are sort of magnified, exaggerated, and to an almost mythic degree, because in California you have the oldest, tallest, largest trees in the world, which were chopped down in the most kind of, you know, venal, capitalist, greedy, horrible, wasteful way. But it's also the place where Americans, and really humans for the first time, protected sacred groves as national parks. It's a place that inspired, you know, a whole conservation and preservation movements around trees. It's also the place where Americans made more money on commercially planted tree crops like oranges, you know, today like almonds, than anywhere else in America. So you sort of see the extremes of the American response to trees in California.
What would California have looked like when people began to migrate there in large numbers in the middle part of the 19th century?
Well, California is a big, complicated place. But if you think about where most of the people live today, which is where people have mostly been living for forever, mm-hmm. is the lowland area. It's the most kind of mild climate, basically under 1,000 feet. And say at the time of U.S. statehood, 1850 or 1848, which is, you know, the U.S.-Mexico War and the Gold Rush, these two like huge earthquakes, if you will, at the same time, most of lowland California did not have many trees. You would have widely spaced and beautiful native oaks of various species growing along the foothills, but mostly it's savanna, it's grassland, it's chaparral, it's marshland, wetland. It's incredibly rich biotically. It's a very rich, you know, human social landscape, an indigenous landscape, you know, full of waterfowl, you know, amphibians, fish, migrating birds, grizzlies, you know, down at sea level. If you think of Los Angeles, it'd be this big coastal plain with meandering rivers. And if there were trees, it'd be more like willows, occasional sycamore. But basically, if you're an American settler coming from Boston or New York, you know, taking the boat all the way around the tip of South America, you'd be puzzled. Here's a climate that seems so great, so warm, the soil's so good, and where are the trees? It seemed like a deficient or there was something wrong or something needed to be fixed about this place. And they went about very quickly what they called improving or fixing this landscape, which involved killing a lot of life forms while bringing lots of other life forms, mostly trees. So, you know, today California has more trees than really any time since the late Pleistocene. It's this incredible landscape revolution, ecological and also social revolution to drain all these wetlands, to, you know, dam rivers, move water hundreds, thousands of miles from mountains to deserts, you know, cutting down, you know, native oaks, replacing them with eucalyptus. But for the large part, it's about changing a landscape of grasses and savanna and wetlands into these kind of high-grade groves of commercial trees and also sort of garden cities that are, you know, they are very beautiful and they smell great. And you get more biodiversity in trees in Los Angeles, which has a, you know, unfair reputation as a concrete wasteland. It has more biodiversity than a rainforest, or it's comparable just in the terms of the number of species of trees from all over the world. You know, they're flowers at all times of the year in Los Angeles. And for many people, that's a big part of the California dream is, you know, fruit and flowers hanging from trees like every month of the year.
Of course, you can get things to grow in that climate. That doesn't mean that they were ideally evolved and suited for that climate.
Right. Yeah. So California does have a Mediterranean climate. It's warm, not hot, you know, cool, not cold, definite rainy season, though it didn't rain at all last year, but short rainy season, long, dry, warm, sunny season. So you can grow almost anything from almost everywhere in the world. Americans basically tried and succeeded. But some plants require a lot of water. They will grow there. So citrus, for example, which, you know, Texas has a big citrus industry as well, not nearly as big as California. But citrus evolved in Southeast Asia. It's a tropical plant. It's a rainforest plant, equatorial. In California, it requires incredible inputs in the soil to kind of make the soil ripe, but mostly water. It's an incredibly water-intensive plant, and it's grown in largely the desert regions of, or quite dry regions of California. So the question is, like, why California? Why not just grow all of our oranges in, you know, Florida and Texas? And the answer has to do with aesthetics, because, like, you can't buy a Texas orange or a Florida orange in a store to eat as a table orange. Like, all the oranges in Florida are juiced. Whenever you buy Minute Maid or a brand like that, it's coming from Florida and it's pulped. You don't see the actual fruit because the fruit is not pretty. It'll be mottled, it'll be green, it'll have spots on it. Whereas those, like, big, beautiful, you know, orange globes that you get now year-round, but it used to be like a special Christmas gift that people would get, right? Those come from California. So California, because it has these specific growing conditions that have to do with, like, temperature variations from morning to night and, you know, month to month, basically the oranges turn a beautiful, consistent orange color. And then they learn through hybridization to pick a certain tree that is uniform all the time and always looks beautiful. So it doesn't actually taste any better than an orange from Brazil or from Florida or Texas, but it looks prettier. It's all about the what consumers see on the outside. So this huge, you know, multi-million, today it'd be a multi-billion dollar industry in citrus in California, is really built on the surface appearances of fruit. And that is a consequence of the California climate. even though this tree is actually not that well suited. You know, it's basically, you know, it's a tropical tree.
Can you tell us about the parent tree?
Yeah, the parent tree, you can actually still visit one specimen in Riverside, California. It is a specimen of what's called a Washington navel. It was first found in Brazil as a mutation or a sport, they call it, on a navel orange. Because orange trees and lemons and other citruses, basically they can have mutations growing on the tree. So you could have like one tree have very different fruits, or you can grow, you know, from seed an orange that'll be totally different than the parent. Mm-hmm. So basically all commercial oranges, and this is true of many commercial tree crops, are done by grafting. They're basically, you're cloning trees by attaching stock from one tree and on rootstock of another. So there was this navel found in Brazil. It tasted good like a navel, but it had very few seeds. That was the great commercial advantage. It was basically seedless. So it was shipped to D.C. This is in the mid-19th century. It was grown in the greenhouse on the National Mall. Basically, because people know people, friends of friends, it ends up being shipped on the Transcontinental Railroad to the Bay Area. It goes on a wagon. It ends up...
Just this one single tree.
Yeah, one single tree. Well, actually, it was a couple. But yeah, basically two trees that made this long, dusty trip. People were like watering the roots on the way across the plains and the Rocky Mountains and the Great Basin. And then, you know, by horse and buggy, eventually arrives in Riverside, which is one of these kind of colonies, horticultural colonies in Southern California. And there was a couple, very, very eccentric couple, the Tibbetts, who were kind of former, kind of utopian abolitionists, spiritualists. And they grew this tree in their backyard, and it not only tasted good, it looked good, and it grew well. It really took to the climate conditions in Southern California. And so pretty soon they were selling, you know, like a little bud from the tree for like a silver dollar. And they had to build a fence around it. And basically this story is that every single commercial navel orange in California, which is the bulk of the citrus crop, then through today comes from that one it's like genetic stock. I mean, they're all clones of each other. And so it was literally like the money tree. And at some point, it was so valuable. And, you know, Riverside became the richest place per capita in America. And like the second richest place per capita in America was Redlands, which was just a few miles down the road. This is where like the 1% of the 1% of their era built their winter hideaways. I mean, now you would buy an island somewhere, right? Or if you were a Silicon Valley billionaire, you would grow grapes. But back in those days, if you were a billionaire, you grew oranges in California as a hobby. And so Teddy Roosevelt, for example, as a sitting president, when he first visits the West Coast, his very first stop is Riverside. Hmm. And he ceremonially replants one of the two parent trees in the courtyard of like the big famous hotel in town, the Mission Inn. Shortly dies, actually. But the second of the parent trees is still kept alive in Riverside. It has almost died multiple times. Their scientists at UC Riverside have kept it alive through grafting on pieces of other trees. So basically, it's like this kind of like cyborg tree now that's sort of kept alive through like very constant human intervention. But you can still visit it. It's right next to like a very nice taqueria.
We're speaking this hour with Jared Farmer. He teaches history at Stony Brook University, and he's in town to receive the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture for his book Trees in Paradise, A California History. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jared Farmer, who teaches history at Stony Brook University and is author of the new book Trees in Paradise, A California History. He's in town to receive the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I always want to be careful about how we ask these questions, but how did the first non-native peoples become aware of the presence of these towering redwoods and sequoias in California?
Okay, so there's two kinds of redwoods. I mean, they're distant evolutionary cousins. There's the sequoia, giant sequoia. It's a Sequoia dendron giganteum. That's what grows in the Sierra Nevada, like near Yosemite, a little south. Those are like the largest organisms, plant organisms, or any kind of organism. Well, it depends on how you count it, because anyway, it's definitely like the largest trees in the world. Mm-hmm. And then you have coast redwood, which is Sequoia sempervirens, which grows just on the Pacific coast, just like on the northern strip of California from like Mendocino up to about the Oregon state line. So they're quite distant from each other geographically, and redwoods grow a little bit taller, at least they can, not quite as massive. So sometimes people confuse the two, so that's why mm-hmm. I mentioned. Actually, they are both the official California state tree. The state attorney general actually made the ruling that the California redwood, which is the state tree, applies to both species. Anyway, so the coast redwood, since it's on the coast and since it is near ports, it was known, you know, from the very beginning to, you know, Russians, to Spaniards, who both did a limited logging. Because we sometimes forget that, you know, Russians were in California before Americans. They were hunting sea otter and actually built a little outpost of the Russian Empire at Fort Ross in Sonoma County. But really, it wasn't until Americans arrived in large numbers after 1848 that people start cutting down redwood trees. And they immediately cut down all the redwoods in the East Bay. Because, like, Oakland had oaks, which are all cut down immediately, too. But all those canyons above Berkeley and Oakland had redwood pockets and were all immediately chopped down because basically San Francisco was built on a sand dune, essentially a peninsula that was a sand dune, and they needed lots and lots of wood. So redwoods were known from the very beginning when Russians and Spaniards arrived. Sequoia is a different story. They are located on the flanks of the Sierra Nevada. They're quite remote. They're hard to get to. And we don't really know when the first non-indigenous person encountered. Probably would be people immigrating to California in the 1840s, though they didn't make a big fuss about it. So really, the effective discovery, which just means, you know, publicity outside of indigenous California, happened during the Gold Rush. So basically, there was a group of miners who were so busy looking for flakes of gold that they couldn't grow or hunt their own food. So they hired a hunter, basically, to, like, find their food for them, who basically shot grizzly bears. And they were eating bear meat. And on one of his hunting trips, he came across a grove. Because one big difference between giant sequoia and coast redwood is that, you know, redwoods grew, they still, it's different now, but they have huge forests, sometimes mixed with other trees, but you would stand on a peak and they would go for miles and miles and miles. Whereas sequoias, the giant sequoias grow in these quite discrete, isolated groves, and you might have 50 miles between one and another, and they're surrounded by other kinds of trees. So and there's only about a few score of these in the whole world, you know, in one mountain range. So they're much easier to miss, and they were hidden from view. Anyway, so
probably to their benefit.
Probably to their benefit. So when this American hunter found it, his campmates didn't believe him. He had to say, "Hey, I found a really, really big bear. You got to see it." And then he took him to this tree and says, "Ha ha! There's the big bear." So that became known as the Discovery Tree. And of course, Americans, being Americans, they basically,
let's kill it.
They cut it down within weeks. And they later danced on it, built a gazebo on it. So basically, Americans, like, when encountering the supreme flora of the earth, just humiliated it by cutting it down. They cut in another one in that grove. And when they did this, for all they knew, this was the only grove of sequoia on earth. They didn't know there were, you know, 60 more out there. And they cut down two within months. And then that one, it was for show. It was for, like, exhibit in New York and Philadelphia and London. So that's kind of that's like the bad part of the story. Like, the good part is that Americans basically invented the idea of the national park at Yosemite. And Yosemite was not initially just about the valley. It was also about the Mariposa Grove, which was the second sort of discovered grove. And when Abraham Lincoln in 1863, about 100 years ago, signed the order that sort of protected this piece of California for the public, he was recognizing that tree, that grove of big trees, as they were called, as well as Yosemite Valley. So it's really at the heart of the American National Park tradition. So that's the kind of weird thing about America. And California is like America, but more so. Everything's like bigger. I mean, I know I'm in Texas, so maybe everything's bigger in Texas too in a different way. But this impulse just to like cut and kill and make money, you find that exaggerated in California, but also to protect and save, you know, sacred groves. And so probably I would say that no tree went from being, you know, relatively unknown or effectively unknown outside of, you know, local indigenous people like Sierra Miwoks and others to being world famous in such a short period of time as giant sequoia. You know, within months, all the botanists of Europe knew about this. They were sending seed collectors to the Sierra Nevada. Within a few years, you had little baby sequoia trees growing in every arboretum in Europe.
And I actually looked online, and there are some spectacular specimens now in northern England and other places.
Yeah, you found them all over the continent. Some big, you know, winters in the late 19th century killed a lot of the ones in Germany. But though there still are some nice sequoias in Germany, but the British Isles are actually perfect climate for sequoias. Mm-hmm. And Queen Victoria planted a number of these. Lord Tennyson had one at his estate. There are some beautiful arboretum in Scotland, you know, the home of John Muir, who we associate with California, that have whole like allées of sequoia trees that sort of seem like worthy of national park status. So these Europeans, they wanted to save the species because Americans might kill them all. It was also out of scientific curiosity, but in their curiosity, they actually sometimes encouraged the killing of sequoia trees because if you want seeds, and that's what they wanted, these minute seeds, they grow high, high, high up in the tall sequoia trees, and many dozens, probably hundreds of immense giant sequoias were cut down just for the seeds to send to, you know, botanists and...
The irony of that is painful.
And Europe, who actually wanted to save the trees.
Yeah. So they are so majestic that they lend themselves to being called upon to commemorate great achievements and great people.
Yeah, that's right. So it's Veterans Day, so it's appropriate to talk a little bit about how trees are used to commemorate the dead. And I want to say that rocks and trees are kind of like the two most common ancient ways humans used to honor the dead. And if you look at our cemeteries, it's a lot of rocks and trees, right? But I want to say like the impulse to use trees to remember the dead has attenuated a bit in the 20th century to today. In the 19th century, this was much more, there was much more tree culture, much more like sylvan focused American society. And so, for example, the National Mall today, we think it's a big lawn surrounded by big buildings and memorials. In the 19th century, it's basically a forest, but it's a planted forest. It's full of memorial trees planted for people. It was a very different way of memorializing our heroes. And there was a proposal to grow a giant sequoia on the mall for George Washington, parallel to the Washington Monument, which was at its time kind of like a strange thing to build this giant obelisk. And it was actually, you know, unfinished for many, many years because of the Civil War. And the sequoia was originally called the Washingtonia Gigantea by Americans, and the British called it the Wellingtonia. There was kind of this like battle. Today, that would be odd, I think, to have like the George Washington tree on the mall. We have a very different relationship with trees. However, if you go back to the 19th century, after the Civil War, after you have the railroad going to California, all sorts of sequoia trees are named after dead military heroes. I mean, famously, there's the General Grant, which was its own national park for a while. It's now absorbed in Sequoia National Park. There's the General Sherman, which strangely was originally called the Karl Marx tree because there were some utopian socialist settlers there. And since I'm in Texas, I'll mention there actually was a Robert E. Lee sequoia tree. And in the same period in New England, there are revolutionary heroes named honored through elm trees. And basically this impulse to use trees to commemorate the dead peaks in World War I. So, you know, Veterans Day really is Armistice Day or Remembrance Day. It's about World War I. And partly because of Joyce Kilmer, who wrote that, you know, schlocky poem Trees, and he died in the war. All throughout the Allied world in France, Australia, Canada, U.S., many, many cities planted whole avenues with trees dedicated to the war dead, and they're often plaques. And this happened in California, but what California added was this concept of the memorial grove. Here we have trees that are already there. They're ancient. They've survived. They are like the perfect monuments or memorials to the dead. And in redwood country, there was the added kind of impetus to save these trees through commemoration because they were all privately owned. If you think of like Woody Guthrie singing that song, like,
yeah,
this land is your land, that was totally not true. As of 1900, 100% of the species was privately owned. I can't think of like another example like this where an entire species is privately owned. And so the fact that we now have all these state parks and national parks, that is really people buying these trees back from timber companies. And eventually it was like state and federal governments doing this. But in the first phase, it was groups, private groups. Today, we would think like Nature Conservancy. Back then, it was a larger group called Save the Redwoods League, which was super duper rich people, like again, like the most elite blue-blooded, a lot of Yaleys, Republicans, New York types, the 1% of their era, who basically bought trees and then commemorated to people like themselves. So the very first Redwood Memorial Grove, the inaugural purchase, was named after Raynell Bowling, who was like the counsel for U.S. Steel and a very powerful rich man who actually volunteered to go to France and died. And so that's sort of like the high point of this kind of movement to kind of use living trees to honor the dead. But it sort of continues. You have a national tribute grove to World War II dead in California. And there's an FDR tree all in here in Muir Woods, which is near San Francisco. So the UN, which basically convened for the first time in San Francisco, this is before New York.
While they were looking for a location, right?
Yeah, and this is actually before the war was officially over. This is between, you know, VE and VJ Day, after Hitler commits suicide, but before the bomb. So all the delegates meet in San Francisco, and then they go to Muir Woods. They actually have a whole, like, session, and the idea is, like, be in this temple, this kind of natural temple, this cathedral of trees, and to kind of, like, soak in the peace. And they dedicate a plaque under a tree to FDR, who recently passed away. And they think about world peace. And again, that's a kind of like a beautiful thing I think we should remember today on Veterans Day, is this kind of long leap between planted trees. And again, many, many cities have planted trees for our soldiers, including many California redwoods in other states, because many people wanted the longest living tree to honor our dead. And the idea was that these trees are practically immortal. They can live to be 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years old. I'm not sure they would in, say, Dallas, but, you know, they would live a very long time. So we have that, but also we have these existing groves in California that were often purchased or otherwise commemorated for our dead.
How did eucalyptus trees become such a fixture on the landscape in California for such a long time?
Yeah, so eucalyptus trees, if you've been to California, especially lowland California, you probably know that smell. It's kind of a tangy, a little bit pepperminty, a little bit of menthol. It mixes with the salt from the ocean. For a lot of Californians, that is the smell of home, especially now that the orange groves are all gone from Southern California. They're all in the Central Valley.
Because the real estate's too expensive.
Yeah, essentially. They all moved long ago. Well, 50s and 60s. It's been 50 years now. So eucalyptus trees, there are many, many species. They're from Australia or Australasia, because it includes, you know, Tasmania and a little bit of the Malay archipelago. But it's overwhelmingly one species. It's called the Tasmanian blue gum. That's where you're going to see if you go to San Francisco or go to Marin or like around San Luis Obispo. There's some other species, but that's the one that is probably like the 90% of the eucalyptus biomass in California is this Tasmanian blue gum. In an earlier era, it was celebrated as like this wonder tree or a miracle tree. Like, it is a tree that in California can grow to sequoia-like sized in a generation.
You don't have to water it.
Don't have to do anything. It'll grow from seed, and that was one huge advantage. You could basically, these are tiny seeds that could be shipped from Australia, and there were a lot of Australians who came to California for the gold rush, and then they brought these seeds with them, and then nurserymen grew them from seed, and then they would grow into these immense, you know, like 200 tall trees, and it would take, you know, like 5 or 6 people to wrap their arms around it, and that's after like 20, 30, 40 years. They would grow to sequoia-like size. So Californians just, I mean, some Californians saw dollar signs in their eyes, and others, they wanted firewood, or they wanted to cure malaria, and they thought that they would do that, or they thought they would change the climate and bring more rain. Or there were lots of these very utopian or just big ideas. And this tree of hope usually was a tree of disappointment in the long run, including like a huge speculative boom, which was kind of like the California answer to tulipomania in the Netherlands, which your audience probably knows about, this kind of frenzied moment where all these like speculators thought they would get rich. Basically, it was about real estate people flipping the land, you know, like planting trees, selling it to suckers, and then leaving them with this land. And a lot of that land then later was just abandoned. And a lot of these huge groves of eucalyptus trees are actually plantations that just basically went feral.
Let me jump in for a second, because you mentioned that there were people who thought that if you put a lot of eucalyptus trees in, you would change the climate and bring more water for the rest of the landscape.
Yeah.
These people were not unfamiliar with horticulture, with agriculture. Where did this kind of thinking get started?
Well, it's, I guess, the it's a version of the rain follows the plow. It's more like the rain follows the tree. And there was a lot of talk among conservationists of the 19th century, not just in America, but throughout Europe, throughout the European empires, about the relationship between tree cover and water supply. And certainly there is a direct relationship between like erosion, between the ability to land to hold in water, runoff, and tree cover. So they weren't like totally off base. But the idea that you would actually increase the rainfall, increase the precipitation, and that was largely wishful thinking. I'll add one more thing. Like one major impulse is just to make it more beautiful. Because again, many of these Americans coming from eastern places, they just love trees. And they thought California was beautiful, but also a little bit kind of weird or deficient, odd that it was had so much, you know, marshland, grassland, and they wanted to like fix that. And often with unintended consequences. And today we often think of it as being like a big mistake. What they considered, you know, a miraculous transformation.
We'll talk a little bit about why they thought it was a big mistake in a couple of minutes with my guest, Jared Farmer. He teaches history at Stony Brook University. He's in town to receive the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture for his new book, Trees in Paradise, A California History. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email me at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Jared Farmer about his book, Trees in Paradise, A California History. So, Jared, for people who are wondering what in the world could have gone wrong with the eucalyptus, explain why it turned out to not be the miracle tree that its champions were hoping.
Okay, there's a couple of reasons. One is it grew too well, too fast, too big, and this will never happen again. This was this isolated moment in Earth history, basically, where you had these trees evolved to be in Australia. Now they're in California, which is an almost identical climate and habitat. Mm-hmm. So it's perfect growing conditions, but there are no insects, you know, fungi, diseases, pathogens, birds, koala, nothing to prey on it. Mm-hmm. So they're growing in like this ideal, unprecedented conditions. And that's why they grew so fast, grew like sequoias almost overnight. And now actually because of globalization and, you know, networks of trade and commerce across the Pacific and all these big container ships, there are all sorts of beetles and other diseases from Australia in California. So the trees are just as sick here as, or sometimes sicker than in Australia. So that's one reason. They grew too big. And so cities actually grew to hate them because they disrupted sewer lines and sidewalks. They like overshadowed houses. They dropped big limbs on houses. So a lot of cities started cutting them down. So that's one reason. Another is that they just, in some areas, became a fire hazard. In large part, this is not because they are by themselves like widow makers or napalm trees or gasoline trees the way that sometimes they are portrayed today, but just because these are big, big plantations planted close together, tightly packed trees. Then they're abandoned. They're not managed. And then after World War II, Californians are building, you know, like real estate developments. They're, you know, they're subdividing, building houses among the trees because they're shady, it's beautiful, they smell good. But that's a huge fire hazard. And, you know, in a dry year like this year, you do get, you know, big fires in California. And there was one kind of pivotal moment in 1991 in the Oakland, Berkeley Hills, where you had this enormous, devastating fire that killed many people and left thousands homeless. And that's, I think, when the kind of the tide of opinion started to turn in the Bay Area. In Southern California, you get that too, but it's slightly less pronounced. So that's two reasons. I guess the third just has to do with this general reevaluation of non-native and native species after 1970s environmentalism. You know, as the science of ecology and the newer science of invasion biology becomes more public knowledge, it's just a much greater emphasis on the importance of native species in ecosystems, and also like the goal, which is often an explicit management goal written into laws, state and national laws after Earth Day in the 70s, that mandate the agencies try to restore earlier conditions. Sometimes it's called like pre-settlement or pre-contact or indigenous or whatever. So in California, that means actually restoring grasslands. It means cutting down trees, you know. So you actually have environmentalists wanting to cut down eucalyptus trees and spray Roundup on the stumps so they don't resprout. So you have these like weird battles in the Bay Area, especially where tree huggers are fighting other environmentalists over trees, because like some environmentalists want to chop them down and others want to preserve them because all trees are sacred and important and beautiful. And basically in California, this has this same battle has replayed over and over and over again, because there are lots of just different jurisdictions. There's, you know, the National Park Service, there's the Cal State Park Service. Different big cities have their own, you know, parks divisions. Right now, the big battleground is the University of California lands at Berkeley, and also at UC San Francisco, the big med school in San Francisco, which has a former plantation right above it, which is a huge fire hazard. So I want to say it's become like hyperbolic at some point, and this sort of like, because of the media age we live in, people like assume that all eucalyptus trees are dangerous all the time, and they're going to burn down, they're going to fall down, they're going to kill you, they're going to crush you.
Spontaneously combust.
They're going to spontaneously combust. And it's more like in certain places in California, they certainly don't belong. Mm-hmm. An unmanaged, feral former plantation in a drought year certainly is very dangerous. But in other settings, they're beautiful. They look great. They can be a wonderful part of the California landscape. They're part of California heritage. And like in most things, like there actually is a middle ground here. And I think, again, it is piece by piece, people are finding that middle ground. But as a historian, it's sort of frustrating looking back and seeing how this battle has happened over and over again in the last, you know, 30 years.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Paula on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Paula.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
I didn't know if you addressed the pine trees and the mountain pine beetle, and more specifically, is there anything like a new species that might come along and replace the pine trees that are devastated by these bugs? Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. My book does not cover pine beetles. There's a pretty good book, I'm going to blank on the title, about the pine beetle crisis in the Rocky Mountains. If you do a little Googling, you will find
You'll find it.
As a science journalist. Mm-hmm. That hasn't affected California as much as, say, New Mexico, Colorado, you know, Wyoming, into Canada and Alaska. This has to do with years of fire suppression combined with drought. And so, yeah, millions and millions of acres of trees have been killed by a variety of pine bark beetles throughout the North American West. So I guess thinking of California, the really kind of scary thing, if you think about global warming and climate change, is that a tree species like giant sequoia, which, you know, according to legend, is practically immortal. There is, they say, you know, this, you read this over and over again in books, there is no disease, there is no bug, nothing can kill this tree except fire or man, you know. And that is true at the moment, but that could just be this kind of isolated moment in time, because they're in these flanks of the Sierra Nevada, high above the frost line, that there aren't any current, you know, like fungal diseases or beetles that can get to it. But we might be entering a phase, you know, it's quite possible in 100 years that it will be, you know, well above like 0 degrees all winter long in the Sierra Nevada. And like, we don't know. And in an age of globalization, which includes diseases and, you know, insects as well as humans and their goods, it's quite possible you're going to find new diseases attacking these supposedly immortal trees. And that's a very scary thing that ecologists are thinking about. Like thinking about, A, do we need to water the trees in the future? There are ecologists actively talking about, like, we need to water sequoia trees. Or do we need to move them? It's called assisted migration. You know, should we start planting sequoia trees further north, knowing that their habitat is going to be changing far faster than they can sort of, you know, trees can't walk. I mean, they can through their seeding gradually move, but they can't move nearly fast enough in a time of global warming. So assisted migration or, you know, three, do we just kind of, you know, sit back and see what happens? But probably like the scariest scenario is some sort of unknown disease or fungus or pathogen or beetle affecting not just sequoias, but say bristlecone pines are in the same category. This is the longest living tree in the world, grows in parts of California, Nevada, and Utah. Right now, it's way, way up high above the alpine zone. So it gets so cold currently that all of the nasty bugs don't get there, but that might change in the future. So that's just one thing to think about. But yeah, great question. And there is that book out there, which is not mine. So get my book, but also look for that book about the bark beetle crisis.
How, Jared, did Southern California come to be associated with palm trees, which, as cool as they look, don't actually do much, right? I mean, they don't provide shade. They're just purely ornamental in many places.
Basically, yeah. There's no shade. There's no fruit. There's no flowers. Can't even climb them if you're a kid. Yeah, they seem like no good trees. But of course, they're incredibly valuable as, I call them aesthetic infrastructure.
Yeah.
Basically, they're there to signify. They're there to mean something. Then that's what they do, is to, you know, have meaning. I mean, the exception would be date palms. And there is a small date palm industry in the hottest parts of the deserts of California and Arizona. But almost all of the trees you see in California are planted just for image value. But of course, that is a huge value of California. I mean, like, one reason I chose this California as my subject and not, say, Texas for a book about trees is that California does have a special relationship with native trees, which are unique and prodigious and wonderful, oldest and tallest, oldest living, but also this incredible commercial value, which is unlike anywhere on the planet, but also this symbolic value, which I think is unlike any other state, because the California dream, I think, is in part about having a lemon tree in your backyard and, like, seeing palm trees on the horizon, you know, that light up at sunset. So how did this happen? Well, I'll try to be quick about it. Spaniards first brought in date palms, mostly for Palm Sunday, not for dates. There is one species of palm native to California, the California fan palm. That's what you see in the oases around Palm Springs. But almost all the palms and all the places in California you see are not native. Like, there are no native palms in Los Angeles, for example. So, but if you go to the old missions, you can see some of the old palms, date palms planted by the Spaniards. But this is largely an American period thing. It's like a post, you know, 1850 phenomenon. And basically, Californians always have this kind of fantasy about palm trees, but the fantasy changes. So sometimes it's Anglos, like, creating a fantasy Spanish past by bringing in palm trees and, you know, building, like, Spanish mission-style buildings. Sometimes they're evoking, you know, the Orient or, you know, Persia or the Sahara or the Holy Land, like, that part of the world. Sometimes it's the Mediterranean. You know, it's like beachside luxury. That's the kind of thing you also see in palm courts and fancy hotels, or it used to be in big cruise ships like the Titanic would have palm courts. But then later, Californians invented their own significations, because those are all kind of imported fantasies, right? So, like, the ones Californians invented have to do with, like, sex, celebrity, Hollywood. That's definitely, like, that's what California contributed to, like, the semiotics of the palm. The other thing California contributed is this close association with cities, and especially city streets and palm trees. Because you would find palms on Mediterranean resorts, right? But this idea of, like, a big gridded city like Los Angeles having rows upon rows, miles upon miles of planted palm trees, planted by the city as a kind of city infrastructure, things that went up with the automobile, that's really a California innovation. I don't know any other place quite like that. You see that in other Sunbelt cities, including Texas. It sort of spread along the I-40 corridor. So you see it in, you know, Phoenix and Tucson and, I want to say, San Antonio, into South Texas in the kind of post-World War II era. But that idea of, like, a city tree, a city palm tree that is associated with roads, cars, that's a California contribution, and the sex, glamour, celebrity, which goes back to the early days of Hollywood.
But now, as they're dying off, cities are deciding not to replace them.
That is true, because they're actually fairly water intensive. They're not drought tolerant. And again, they don't cool the air much. They don't sequester much carbon. They don't provide what people call, ecosystem services that cities want, because basically the perfect city tree nowadays uses not a lot of water, but cleans the air, provides maximal shade, does all these like things that a palm tree just can't do. So the palm tree can do all these important value-added things for like the tourism industry. And I think you will always see it, at hotels, at resorts. You will always see it on Hollywood and Sunset Boulevards in Los Angeles, because the city, even though they announced we are not planting more fan palms, made a specific exemption for Hollywood and Sunset Boulevards, because tourists come there to see palm trees, among other things, and they will still see them there. But in other parts of the city, they will use other trees or sometimes other kinds of palm trees that are smaller, shadier, less water intensive. So yeah, L.A. will have far fewer palm trees in 50 years than today, but you would just have to go down the road to Irvine, and there'll be plenty of palm trees there.
So if you were looking at Texas and wanted to tell the history of Texas through trees, I saw you making a little list of trees that we all might consider, whether or not you actually write a sequel to this book and focus on Texas.
I'm not going to write a sequel to this book, but yeah, I'm originally from Utah, so I have my four Utah trees. I want to say that maybe no other state, though, deserves a four-tree book. But I do think maybe you could do, like, four non-human things in a state history, especially, like, a big state like Texas. I was thinking, like, say, Washington State. I was thinking, like, Pacific salmon, sea otter, Douglas fir, and the apple would be my four. Why four? I don't know. It could be three. It could be ten. I don't know. There are these kind of magic numbers in publishing. Four is a good number. And Texas, I mean, it would have to be cattle. Cattle is king. Cotton is king, too. You have two kings in Texas. Pecan, I would say. You would have to do pecan, like the great native tree. Then the fourth, maybe your audience could chip in. You suggested live oaks. That seems like a very good choice. I might say peyote cactus, just to kind of like mix things up.
That's only part of the state, though. That's the problem.
That is true. That's right. Do you think oaks would be the fourth?
I don't know. I mean, they live a long time, and they're very hardy. But I don't know if they grow much outside of Texas. I know they're in the other parts of the South. You can find them in
right. Yeah, you've got the Gulf Coast. There's some amazing oaks.
Yeah. So well, maybe we can hear from people via Twitter. We're about out of time here, but Jared Farmer teaches history at Stony Brook University. He's in town to receive the Hyatt Prize from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
And Jared Farmer's new book is called Trees in Paradise, A California History. Jared, it's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help from Marshall Noor on the phones today. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.